Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Simon Harrick, Jesuit priest and an organizer with the War Resisters League, who explains why 25 peace activists have traveled to the American naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to protest U.S. torture of detainees. Gregory Wilpert, a journalist living in Caracas who examines Venezuela's recent legislative election, where President Hugo Chavez won an overwhelming victory after opposition parties boycotted the vote. And Alden Meyer of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who assesses the progress made at the recently concluded United Nations Climate Change Conference in Montreal. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Rumors of a new American military base in Paraguay have been circulating since the South American government agreed to allow 13 U.S. joint military exercises that will run through December 2006. It is speculated the U.S. would establish a new military base only 124 miles from the border with Bolivia, in easy striking distance of Bolivia's rich natural gas fields, and that up to 500 U.S. troops would be based there. In late July, Brazil launched its own military maneuvers along the border region with Paraguay. In addition, Brazil's foreign minister, Celso Amorim, chastised its neighbor for inviting in the American military. According to the news magazine In These Times, Bolivia, which will have a closely contested presidential election on December 18th, has the most to fear from a U.S. base. For the last 2 years, massive protests by indigenous groups have rocked the nation and toppled two presidents. In polls for a new election, Evo Morales of the left-wing Movement Towards Socialism, or MAS party, holds a slim lead over former President Jorge Quiroga Ramirez, preferred candidate of the U.S. While Washington and Paraguay have denied any plans for an American military base, a recent trip by U.S. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld fueled speculation that the Bush administration was eager to block Morales' election. Morales, the leader of coca leaf farmers and a good friend of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, has endorsed calls to nationalize Bolivia's natural gas reserves. The Washington Post reports that a newly disclosed 2003 memo shows that six staff lawyers in the U.S. Justice Department and two analysts asserted the Texas Congressional Redistricting Plan, pushed by then-House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, violated the Voting Rights Act, but that top officials in the Justice Department overruled staff opinion and approved the redistricting plan. DeLay is now under indictment in Texas for illegally diverting funds to the campaigns of Republican state legislators who drew the new map. Critics charged the plan, which used three-year-old census data and led to Republicans winning five new congressional seats, violated the concept of one person, one vote, and weakened the voting power of blacks and Hispanics. To dismantle a Latino-majority district for the explicit purpose of making sure they can't elect a candidate of their choice is a violation of the Voting Rights Act, said Nina Perales, Southwestern Regional Counsel for the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. On Monday, December 12th, the Supreme Court agreed to consider the legality of the 2003 plan. Oral arguments will begin March 1, 2006, just 1 week before congressional primary races. Democratic Representative Lloyd Doggett, who saw his Austin and Travis County district dismantled in 2003, welcomed the court's decision to hear the case. He said, "With all this talk of spreading democracy abroad, I'm hopeful there might be some spreading of democracy at home now." Under the threat of a boycott from the arch-conservative American Family Association, Ford Motor Company has agreed to stop advertising its Jaguar and Land Rover vehicles in gay publications. Ford claimed it was a business decision, at the same time the car giant announced it was laying off 7,500 workers. The Mississippi-based AFA first targeted Ford in April for the carmaker's programs encouraging workplace diversity for gay and lesbian workers and making donations to gay rights groups like the Human Rights Campaign. Over the summer, conservative Christians put pressure on local Ford dealers in southern states. The dealers then urged top Ford executives to settle with the anti-gay AFA. However, the Ford-owned Volvo company will continue to run ads in gay publications. In a statement, AFA Chairman Donald Wildman praised Ford, saying, "They are acting on our concerns. We are pleased with the results, and therefore the boycott has been suspended." A joint statement by 19 gay rights groups expressed deep dismay that Ford entered into a confidential agreement with the AFA and called on the car company to disavow it. In response, Ford has agreed to meet with gay rights leaders in mid-December to explain its dealings with the Anti-Gay American Family Association. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Allegations that the U.S. systematically mistreats and tortures terrorist suspects was the focus of attention again when Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice denied charges that Washington operates secret prisons in several Eastern European countries. Investigations have been launched by the European Union into the complicity of governments where these prisons may be located and whose territory may have been used to transport detainees. While President Bush and other U.S. officials have stated that America does not torture, prisoners who have been released from Guantanamo Bay have alleged that they were menaced with dogs and beaten while in American military custody. In protest of the treatment of terrorism suspects held at the Guantanamo Bay U.S. Naval Base in Cuba and other known and covert facilities around the world, 25 American Christian activists traveled to the gates of the prison and are demanding to meet with the detainees held there. The human rights campaigners flew to Cuba, then marched 80 miles on foot from Santiago to Guantanamo, arriving there on December 10th, International Human Rights Day. The group now sits at the gate, fasting and praying while awaiting permission to enter the U.S. base. Thus far, the Bush administration has not responded to the group's request. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Simon Harrick, Jesuit priest and anti-militarism coordinator with the War Resisters League. He explains why members of the War Resisters League and Catholic worker communities from across the U.S. have converged on Guantanamo in their witness to torture, protesting government policies that have led to the mistreatment of detainees.
They wanted to draw attention to the over 500 prisoners that we have there in Guantanamo Bay who are held there without charge and without evidence, with secret evidence. So they don't know how they got in there, and they don't know how to get out. It's just remarkable. And in the meantime, while they're in this legal black hole that we've created, they are being tortured. The Red Cross made an extraordinary act. They usually are quite private about this, but they actually came out and said, no, these people are being tortured. They use the word tantamount to torture. So the Catholic workers and a number of the people from the WRL said, well, if this were happening on American soil, would we be there? And the answer was, of course, yes. But now they say, well, then what's to stop us from going to Cuba, especially since, as Catholic workers especially, we have the injunction from Jesus to visit the imprisoned, especially because the president on June the 20th said, well, if you're concerned, there were a whole bunch of people who were concerned about this. They said, well, he said, if you're concerned, well, then I invite you to go down there yourself to see there and to look at the facts. That's what the president said in Washington, D.C. So they did, of course. Now they're at Guantanamo awaiting for his permission to enter this prison camp where the torturing is taking place. And surprisingly enough, he's not giving it, even though they're responding to his invitation.
So what's the status? They walk from Santiago de Cuba. Where are they now, and are they at the gates?
Just outside the base. There's a kind of a no man's land, as you know, between the Cuban forces and the American forces, and they're outside that no man's land, and they're fasting now and praying and asking people to call up the president and Rumsfeld and say, let us in.
Tell us, what's the primary message these 25 activists have brought to the gates of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba?
That the people in the United States, at least some people in the United States, do not approve of holding people without due process, without charge, without being able to see any evidence against them, and that these people do not approve of torture. And not only is that message that these walkers want to give, but there's a lawyer from Harvard, educated lawyer, Jennifer Harbury, who's been doing a long study on the effects of torture. She herself interviewed many people who were heads of intelligence services across the world for the past 10 years, And these folks say that they have not received, all over the world for the past 10 years, what they call actionable intelligence from torture. So that even if you were for human rights, which these people are, even if you aren't for the dignity of human beings, which as Christians they are, then even if you were saying that we need actionable intelligence, well, the intelligence heads across the world, including the United States, say we never get any actionable intelligence from this because people will say anything under torture. So I think the other thing, too, finally, that because it's an explicitly Christian, even Catholic worker group, they also want to expose the hypocrisy of a government that claims to be Christian, that is torturing people and holding them without charges. If we want to go that far, saying on what side of the crucifixion would our government be? These folks are on the side of the people who are being crucified. Well, then what's the government doing? Our own government, which claims to be Christian, is doing the crucifying. So that's also something that they want to highlight as they walk there.
Reverend Herrick, the president and his advisors, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, have gone out of their way in recent weeks to assure the world that torture is not taking place, that the United States does not torture people held in captivity, that prisoners are not being shuttled to secret detention centers and tortured. How do you respond to the idea that the torture that has been reported, that this is all somehow an aberration, a group of bad apples that have defied their instructions from their superiors, that this is somehow just a few mistakes and not a policy?
They want to say if it's a few mistakes, then the question is, then how come it's repeated over and over again in every prison? It's every prison. There's not only, of course, Abu Ghraib, where the torture continues in Iraq, but there's Camp Buqqa and other camps, and the torture is exactly the same. And then when you go to Guantanamo and look at the torture that's taking place there, that's exactly the same. And then when people come back from these secret prisons, if they ever do get out, the handful that have gotten out report how they're being tortured. And there are a number of British people who have just been released a few months ago, and they report on their torture, and it's all the same. When you see in case after case across the world that the torture that we're inflicting on people is the same, then it's hard to argue that it's a few bad apples. It looks much more like a universal policy. And when we look at the manuals for how to torture people that come from the School of the Americas, now we renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, those manuals describe the kind of torture that we are training others to do that we are now inflicting.
That was Simon Herrick, Jesuit priest and anti-militarism coordinator with the War Resisters League. Contact the League by calling area code 212-228-0450 or visit the Witness to Torture website at www.witnesstorture.org. In another of a string of victories, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has won an overwhelming victory in his nation's December 4th legislative election. The president's Fifth Republic Movement won 114 out of 167 seats in the National Assembly, while allied parties won the balance. However, this electoral victory came after five major opposition parties boycotted the vote, resulting in only 25% participation by registered voters. The opposition parties, many of which supported the unsuccessful 2002 military coup against Chavez, complained that Venezuela's National Electoral Council favored government candidates, despite major changes made by the council in response to opposition grievances. President Chavez claimed the opposition's boycott of the election was prompted by polls showing they would have suffered an embarrassing defeat, a tactic he says that was backed by Washington to destabilize his government. Now, with commanding control of the legislature, Chavez will have a two-thirds majority in parliament that will allow him to change the Constitution, including a current limit of two presidential terms in office. Meanwhile, Venezuela is continuing its charm offensive by offering Caribbean nations, and now poor residents of Boston and New York, discounts on oil through its state-owned energy company, brand name Citgo in the U.S. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist and journalist living in Caracas who examines Venezuela's recent legislative election.
For a long time, the opposition parties here have been complaining about the Electoral Commission, which regulates and organizes the elections. And they had a number of different complaints. And actually, the Electoral Council or Commission gave in to almost every single one of the demands of the opposition parties leading up to the vote. For example, the Electoral Council had wanted to have fingerprint scanners to make sure that nobody votes more than once. But the opposition said that that would reveal the secret of the vote, perhaps, if you can correlate those fingerprint scans with the order in which people voted and, you know, when exactly they voted because they're voting machines. But the council actually decided to remove those, to concede to the opposition demand. But still, even though right after they conceded to one of these main demands, and actually there were a whole bunch of them, something like five or six separate demands, a couple days beforehand they withdrew from the election with no really good explanation other than we don't trust the Electoral Council. And so as a result, the participation, of course, was very low. That's something else that was covered extensively in the news, that only 25% participated, but they were essentially uncontested elections. That's, well, it's not quite true. There were something like over 5,000 candidates for something like 187 seats, positions. So there were plenty of candidates, but the main opposition parties were not participating. And so it was clear that the opposition supporters wouldn't vote, and even Chavez supporters didn't really feel like voting either, since they were pretty certain that their side would win, which, of course, turned out to be true. The pro-Chavez side ended up getting all of the seats of the National Assembly in the end. And Chavez's own party, since he governs in a coalition, won something like two-thirds of the seats.
Greg Wilpert, there's been some speculation that public opinion polls foretold of a drubbing by Chavez's allied parties against the opposition, and that is one reason why they pulled out of the election. What have you heard about some of their motivation for pulling out?
Yes, I really think that's the main reason. The polls indicated that Chavez himself enjoys something like between 60 and 70% popularity, and it looked like the opposition parties would go down from almost half of the seats in the National Assembly to something like maybe 20 at the most out of 165 seats. So it seemed pretty clear that this was a preferable route for them, because that way they could continue their campaign of delegitimizing the Chavez government without having to face almost certain defeat at the polls. And there are actually several different things that indicate that this was the case, that their decision was based on this. For example, some of the main opposition parties never even campaigned. Leading up to the vote, a few days beforehand, before they pulled out, you couldn't see a single campaign poster of theirs on the street. So you really got the impression that they actually never had any intention at all of participating.
So did they not achieve the desired effect? Because here in this country, there are many people who are now calling, or who have long been calling, Hugo Chavez a dictator, and are reiterating that charge now that he has almost complete control of the government, with the opposition members of parliament drying up, basically, in the aftermath of this parliamentary election.
Well, here the opposition definitely thinks like it won a victory, which seems very bizarre. They're saying essentially that, yes, in international opinion, Chavez is going to be seen as a dictator and so on, and running a one-party state and all these kinds of arguments. But actually, when you look at the international media, at least, in terms of the op-ed pieces, while they are usually against Chavez, they are also unanimous in their condemnation of the opposition. Actually, the Washington Post, I don't know, most people don't even realize nowadays, is actually become extremely conservative in terms of its editorial. And they've always hated Chavez, but they clearly are saying that the opposition made a big mistake and they acted like fools. And the New York Times actually had an editorial that said the same thing, essentially. So even though I don't agree with their position on what they're saying about Chavez, it doesn't seem like this was a victory for the opposition.
Greg, when it comes to the program of Hugo Chavez's government, now that they have undisputed control of the parliament, what is the government program? What can they do with this lopsided majority that they now have in terms of participatory democracy that they're pushing, social programs, press laws that the opposition has protested in recent months?
Well, I don't think much is going to happen in terms of press laws. I mean, the law that they passed essentially have regulations that are very comparable to the U.S. FCC regulation, broadcast regulations. But it goes further in many ways, not in terms of restricting the media, but in terms of democratizing it, actually. What's more likely on the agenda, I think, are perhaps two things. The more important one, I think, is efforts to continue inventing, so to speak, a participatory democracy. That is, they want to strengthen what's known here also as the social economy, to make it easier, for example, for the government to take over factories that have become bankrupt and turn them over to workers in order to continue production as a cooperative. Another thing, there are two laws they're working on right now. One has to do with strengthening and creating community councils to strengthen community and local democracy, and another has to do with turning over the property of the homes that people built in the slums. And almost half of Venezuelan population lives under such circumstances, and the effort is to turn over that land to the people who are living in it and have been living on it for almost 20 years in some cases.
That was Gregory Wilpert, a sociologist and journalist living in Caracas. Read his articles online at www.venezuelaanalysis.com. As representatives of 163 nations wound up climate change talks in Montreal in mid-December, many environmental groups were critical of what they saw as a lack of progress, and particularly the negative role of the U.S. government. Under the Bush administration, the U.S. unsigned the 1992 Kyoto Protocol Global Warming Treaty. The protocol sets a goal for industrialized nations to reduce carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions by 5% below 1990 levels by 2012, and to reduce emissions by 20 to 30% by the year 2020. The U.S., which currently produces 25% of emissions, is among the very few industrialized nations, including Australia, that have declined to participate in the Global Warming Treaty. Kyoto goals do not currently apply to developing nations such as India and China, even as emissions from those countries are contributing a greater percentage to the total amount of gases produced worldwide. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alden Meyer, an energy specialist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who has been working on climate change issues since 1989. While many analyses of the Montreal gathering believe the only result was to agree to more meetings, Meyer, who was very critical of the U.S. role, was nevertheless upbeat about the meeting and what it portends for the future of climate change work.
Clearly, the United States came in there hoping to derail the Kyoto Protocol and weaken the resolve of Europe, Canada, Japan, and other countries from moving ahead with the notion of binding limits on greenhouse gas emissions. And that strategy failed because they decided at this meeting in Montreal to launch the next round of negotiations over deeper cuts in industrial country emissions after 2012, and also to create a forum for constructive discussions with major developing countries like China, India, Brazil, about ways that they can participate more actively in the regime that's emerging globally.
Now, who's the they in this process?
The countries that are parties to the Kyoto Protocol, those that have signed up. So, of course, that does not include the United States, which under Bush pulled out of the whole process.
Are you just putting a happy face on this, or am I reading the wrong sources? The things I've been reading since the start of this latest meeting in Montreal have painted a much less rosy picture. I mean, the U.S. tried to derail the whole process. Are you only happy because that didn't happen? That seems like a pretty low bar to set.
No, actually, that was a major victory for people who would like to see tougher action in the future. I think the real political message out of Montreal is that the rest of the world realized, many of them for the first time, that the Bush administration position does not truly reflect where public opinion and action are going in the United States. There were a number of mayors up in Montreal, staff from governors, some of the states that are moving forward on their own, the business community initiatives that are underway, the religious groups. There was a lot of stuff on display up in Montreal for the rest of the world to see about how so much is happening in the U.S. outside of Washington, D.C., where, of course, both the Congress and administration are paralyzed by the fossil fuel lobby. And that gave Europe, Japan, Canada, some of the other countries the courage to go ahead with the Kyoto Protocol process, despite the fact that the Bush administration is making clear that they will not come back in. I think people are now looking beyond this administration, looking at where the U.S. is going on this issue longer term, the likelihood that the next president, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, will be much more proactive and willing to reengage with the rest of the world on the global warming issue. And they launched a process to start those discussions among themselves without the U.S. at the table able to block it. And that was the real goal that many of us had for this meeting, was to launch a strong process coming out to discuss the next steps after 2012.
Altenmeyer, I read an article where another scientist was quoted as saying that it's really too late already and we're toast, in his words. Do you think that's too negative?
Well, I think it clearly is getting late, and we would agree with those who say that there has to be much more of a sense of urgency around this, that basically we've really got the next 10 years to turn this situation around and start getting real action on the ground. But the reality is, if you look at what is happening in countries like China, they're not signing up for binding national limits like Europe and Canada did in the Kyoto Protocol, but they are taking some pretty significant steps at the domestic level. For example, China has set a goal of increasing renewable energy share of its electricity sector to 15% over the next decade. They are putting in place stronger fuel economy standards for new vehicles, passenger vehicles, than we have here in the U.S. So if you look at what's actually happening on the ground in some of these countries, there's a lot of good movement forward. We think that if they can be encouraged to come into the Kyoto process and link into some of the technology transfer and the financial markets that are being developed for carbon emission reductions there, that can help accelerate that process.
That was Altenmeyer of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the group by calling area code 617-547-5552 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.